You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Blessed above all of creation, it was a rare and precious pearl. Conceived in faith and liberty, home of the brave, land of the free, it was the envy of the world. But this shining city on a hill has turned from the Creator's will and let evil take control. The reckless men who lead them want to strip away their freedom and to steal their very soul. Now it's smoke and mirrors, switch and bait, criticize, confiscate, and let the guilty walk away. In this once righteous, godly nation, in the halls of education, they forbid the child to pray. They say we need to spread the wealth. They pretend to guard the health of the feeble and the poor. While the hand they hold behind their back confuses and conceals the fact that the wolf is at the door. There's an unseen hand.
I see that we've got some of our guests on. We're getting ready to do Connecting the Dots on Genocide in the Second America. Part two, and it looks like Harry Bouyans is with us. Jason Bartlett, who is joining us, I'm kind of hoping that the daylight savings time didn't screw a few people up. That we are supposed to have John B. Wells and Brendy Wells are supposed to be joining us as well as Hedrick from South Africa. So I look forward to this is going to be another great show. Harry, I want you to lead in because I want you to talk about, as a very, very brief, very quick synopsis of the fact that South Africa was not stolen from the black Africans who were living there at the time that the settlers came to the South Cape. So please very quickly give our listeners a really good rundown on that.
Okay, so how do I capture 300 and something years really quickly? First of all, when the Dutch landed at the Cape in 1652, there were no black people on the beach. In fact, they were 700 miles away to the east. Now, you can go and calculate how far that is in American terms, but it'll get you from the East Coast to very deep into the United States. That's the first point. History proceeded, and in the end, what we had was a horrific, absolutely horrific genocide. Black on black in South Africa. It was known as the Mfetane, the Great Crushing. And it happened between 1816 and 1836, mostly at the hand of a great Zulu leader, the guy who really created the Zulus, and his name was Shaka. And you could put the name Shaka into Google. You'll very quickly find a TV series called Shaka Zulu. He pretty much obliterated every other nation, cleared out most of what is now the province of Natal, pushed everybody north and south. Then he crossed the mountains to the west and he obliterated everybody in the interior. And the people who used to be there fled in all but one of the wind directions. They fled southeastward into the mountains where they became the formation, or it caused the formation of the so-called Basutu people, or the South Sutu. Today, that is an independent country called Lesotho. You can see the central brown arrow where it says 6,000 feet freezing winter prairie. Just below it is a little dotted line blue circle in the mountains. They fled there. The other people went west into the Great African Sand Basin, the Kalahari Desert, and others fled north. And as though that wasn't bad enough, one of his lieutenants, or lieutenants, since I'm speaking to Americans, one of his lieutenants broke away, and then he created his own disaster all over the interior of South Africa. And who wasn't yet dead and not yet driven to cannibalism was then driven to cannibalism. And the interior of the country to the east of that green dotted line became a ginormous combination of two no man's lands, one for the Zulu king, who by then was a new guy called Dingane, and the other for Mtsilikazi, who was the rebel lieutenant. So between these guys, they basically just chased everybody else out of there. And I can, if you'll allow me, I can read you what it looked like. Not in my words. You should never just believe me. If I tell you anything, folks should go and check for themselves. I'm a science guy. I am used to having everything I do double-checked. Here are the words of the Reverend Casales in 1830, mid-early 1830. And he wrote, "That which struck us most particularly on arriving," this is in the interior of the country, "was the solitary and desolate aspect of the country. Vainly did our eyes wander in search of the hamlets, the groups of laborers so naturally associated in the mind with the idea of a fertile and variegated soil. Human bones whitening in the sun and rain appeared on all sides. And more than once we were obliged to turn out of our way in order that the wheels of our wagon might not pass over these sad remains. In case you think that was just a one-off in a little spot, here's his colleague, Thomas Arbusset, who was crossing the eastern drainage at the headwaters of the important Vaal River, hundreds of miles to the north. He said, 'There is nothing in this place to enliven the fancy. There are fields of, these are the fields of the dead, and Ezekiel himself would have groaned in spirit had he seen with his own eyes these fields covered with human bones.'" And lastly, further south, near Kuneng, not far from the present Ficksburg, Arbusset again commented, "In the neighborhood there is a number of deserted kraals," that those would be little towns of black people, "and everywhere around the ground is covered with human bones and skulls and broken pots and such like remains." That is what that interior looks like. Do not let anybody else tell you lies. These were the French missionaries who went there to help these people, and what they found were bleached human skeletons. So I can quote you my own people who rode through there and who said the same, but nobody will believe us because we are white men in Africa. So I'd rather quote you the French, because we are obviously not to be believed. I have the wrong color face.
Well, Harry, I have been following a lot of the information that you've been giving me, and I've been double checking on your information, not because I don't, that I doubt you, but I'm kind of like you. I'm inquisitive, and I want to know that everything we're saying here is absolutely correct. And the fact that you're saying this, the Dutch first landed in 1652, and they were saying that clear up almost 200 years later, they were saying that it was still unoccupied, and where they did run across evidence of humans being there, they were actually bleached bones of people who had been killed by Shaka Zulu and some of the other tribes, correct?
Let me explain. If Thumper could be so good as to put up, I have to quickly check which map it is, but could we look at, good Lord, where is it now? We can take image 4B would be a great one to use. 4B, if Thumper could help me with that. The situation is that you may recall in the previous image we showed these brown arrows moving. Those were people migrating from the north. And to summarize last time's conversation, basically the black people of South Africa are indigenous African people who moved from the tropical part of the world into South Africa, which is not tropical. I need for you to see in that drawing that's on the screen right now, notice the dotted red line. That's the Tropic of Capricorn. North of it would be the tropics. This tropical people was migrating out of the tropics into the temperate part of Africa. And so they were moving down in three major prongs, for which we'd have to go to an earlier diagram, the one that was on earlier, but let's not do that, it'll waste time. If you see where it says desert, written in fairly big letters, just to the right of that is semi-desert. One group of people came down that direction along the Mariko and Harts rivers. Another group came along the coast. And a third group came down the middle. The group that came down the middle stopped essentially at the tropical area, at the Tropic of Capricorn. And they are the people of the current president of South Africa. His name is Cyril Ramaphosa, and it's he who is in charge of attempting to take white people's land. Now, his people, his own people, only arrived in the 1650s to 1660s. So they were contemporary arrivals with the white people. His people arrived in the north. My people arrived in the south. So there you can see the arrow that's marked Venda, the brown arrow marked Venda in the left-hand diagram. That would be the people of the current state president. To the west of that, you see arrows marked Sotho. They split up into two heaps, but they were moving through the semi-desert area. And reasonably peaceable folks, far more interested in looking after their cattle and trading than anything else. And then the Nguni people along the coast, who strung themselves out like a string of beads from the Fish River, which is the Blue River in the far south. That area had historically been the border between white and black along the coast. And after various messes by the British government in Britain, I have to be clear about that, it was not a problem with the governor at the Cape. It was the government in Britain who messed up something awful. And my own folks decided they'd had enough. They put their Bibles and their families on their ox wagons, and they trundled off northward at a handful of miles an hour. They went north into so-called darkest Africa. And it so happens that they did that in 1836, which was at the end of this great Mfokane process. There were only the two no man's lands that you can see in the drawing on the right. I just need to see that drawing myself. So yeah, you can see a purplish no man's land on at the coast. I called it Shaka's no man's land. And that surrounded a green patch where it shows Dingaan, the king of the Zulu. And then you see a blue no man's land or gray-blue no man's land in the middle of that part of the world. And in the far west of that, you see a darker blue patch, and that's where Kigumtsilikatsi was. He was the renegade chief, the renegade lieutenant of the Zulu king. So between those two heaps of Zulus, they had basically obliterated everybody in that part of the world. But the folks who had more or less lived there were only ever in a sort of a horseshoe around that territory. If you look at the light pink red area, you see words like Griqua and Korana. Those were Khoi people. They were not black people. Mostly they were of mixed white and Khoi descent. And they had horses and guns. Immediately north of them, you see the word Tlaping, T-L-H-A-P-I-N-G, Tlaping. Those were the southernmost black people in that part of the world. And then there was this huge unoccupied patch to the east of them. And I can find you the writings of the British missionaries who said the country to the east of them was empty. It's only when you got to the mountains that you found the remnant Sutus hiding in those mountains. And then much further north, the other people had been chased into a sort of a semicircle. These ancestors of mine ended up in two major fights with those two Zulu kings, defeated them. But in the case of the Zulu along the coast, they respected the fact that that was the Zulu's homeland. You don't go and take it. That's not right. And in the other territories, they, for example, traded the land from the one chief, Makwana, who had only a couple of men anyway, so he left in the end and joined the others in the mountain. So mostly they acquired that land by treaty, by agreement, but there were areas around the perimeter of this area in the right-hand map. There are areas there that everyone has always very legitimately considered to be black people's territory. And the same is true at the bottom of the map in the green area where you can almost just make out the word Xhosa. Nobody has ever disputed that that's the Xhosa people's land. It's wrong to take it. The British did. That was wrong. And I think it should never have happened. But everywhere else, it was done either by treaty or because when they got there, there was no one there. They were just skeletons. And that's the story.
Okay. Well, that Harry, that's a good lead-in. It sounds like, Pamphlet, you've got some breaking news that you wanted to share with us, something going on in Virginia. We'll just break in for a minute for that. It looks like maybe Pamphlet took off. Thumper, do you know what that breaking news is?
No, I don't. Looks like he stepped away for a moment. Okay. I'll just be watching for him. Just keep an eye on chat. And
yeah. Okay. We'll look for him to show up again. Okay. Harry, the thing that we've been talking about, we've talked about it a number of times. The Zulu were really rough on most of the other black races, as well as, for that matter, the white race when they ran into them eventually, but it took a while. They were rough on those other races. What was the primary cause of that?
They were in the way. Mm-hmm. Look, the... What happened there, it becomes a very complex story, and folks can look on my blog. I have a huge article. It's a long thing, but I hope to make it the defining piece of work on that series of events. I called it the Mfokane, 20 years of hell on earth, and what the black people of South Africa went through over that period, it's just indescribable. I mean, those missionaries, when they got there, they describe how they find the people busy basically cannibalizing bodies, okay? And I can read that to you if you want to, but it's just awful. They've been reduced to that, you know? Mm-hmm. It's really terrible. And so you're at a situation where Shaka, for reasons that only he can explain, decided that he was going to subjugate everybody around him. And as he did that, those nations that were only slightly less warlike and slightly less proficient at fighting, they would move away from him and they had to eat. What are they going to do? Mm-hmm. So they fall upon the next nation. They take all their cattle. They kill everybody. Okay, those people, what's left of them, they flee, and they're basically one, you know, given that they were up against the Indian Ocean, a large chunk fled north. And they actually moved as far as the area of Central Africa, like places like Tanzania. and Burundi and those places. They went as far as that. Mm-hmm. So this upheaval caused by the Zulu messed up things all the way up to the equator. Mm-hmm. It's something like an upheaval in the southern United States going as far as Ecuador, man. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about here.
Sure.
And others fled south, but they were then pushed in amongst Mandela's Xhosa's people, so that caused a mess in that area. And then, as I said, the Tswana people, they fled into the desert, where they also made a miserable existence. It's just utter misery caused by this Zulu upheaval. And certainly in that process, well, let me put it to you like this. These folks still have their songs and remnants of their culture today. And let me assure you that in the center of the country, their songs are still very much like you would have with some of the native folks in North America who capture things in song and in stories. Just so they have their songs and stories, and their songs are still about how the Zulu came and killed them. They haven't forgotten. And believe me, as I've described it to some people, in the end, South Africa is going to end up a total bloodbath between the Zulu and the Xhosa, and the others are going to hide under the bed.
Mm-hmm. I hear you.
They know they can't face them.
Jason, I see that you're on. Would you mute your mic, please? Because we're getting background noise from you. Thank you. Okay. Harry,
yes, sir.
One of the things that I think is important for people to understand, when the Boer run into the blacks of various nations in the interior, did they go in and attack their villages and try to kill these people, or were they just trying to move out of other people's areas and find their own homeland? Wasn't that kind of the direction of the Boer?
Again, not entirely that simple. There's the period between about 1780 and 1836. Over that period, there were a number of wars on the eastern frontier exclusively with the Amakosa people, Mandela's group, so to speak. Mm-hmm. In the end, there would be a total of 9 wars with them. Most of those fought between the British and the Amakosa. But the first two, the Dutch were in charge. And the British would always call up my Afrikaner ancestors to help them, because they'd call up the Boer militia. Essentially, that's what it boils down to, okay? Just like Americans had a militia to fight the Brits, our guys had a militia, because that's what you did. You were isolated, you were few, you were in a dangerous area. You would make sure that you can shoot, you would make sure that you know where to find one another, and you would make sure that you knew what a field of fire was and how to shoot properly. So they were roped into that. Now let's move on to when they went on the Great Trek, when they went north. In other words, when they moved. So I think that's really what you're asking about. They did not go north with the intent of taking someone's land. In fact, when they went north, they were helped by the first collection of black people they met with. And those people had already been chased around by the Zulu, so that they offered to help fight. So let the record reflect that the people at what is now called Tabanshu, that was Chief Moroka. Chief Moroka gave the white guys part of his army to go up against Ntsilikazi, the renegade Zulu chief. He's the guy who occupied the far northwest. You may remember that gray area in the map, the gray no man's land. That was Mtsilikazi's no man's land. So when they went up against Mtsilikazi in the end, they did so with the help of those guys. But they didn't just go up against them to go and fight and take their land. They were attacked. They were openly and clearly first attacked, and it's Americans who reported it, okay? Because they were American missionaries with Mtilikazi. Their job was, they got sent to go and see if they could convert Mtilikazi to Christianity. They had absolutely zero achievement there. And when the my guys then went north to in retribution against Mtilikazi, those Americans couldn't very well stay around. If they had survived my guys' attack and Mtilikazi came back, he would have killed them. They knew that. They understood that. So they left with my ancestors and came further back south. In the case of Dengaan, if you look along that map that's now up there, it shows the Tugela River and a red cross, which means a British mission station, London Missionary Society mission station. The Reverend Owen was there, stationed there, and in very early February 1838, the Trekkers, a contingent of 100 men, went to visit Dengaan, and the job was to sign the final agreement for the patch of land to the south of Dengaan. The contract was drawn up by the missionary in English. The chiefs put their crosses there. The other important counselors of the Zulu put their crosses there. Some of my Boer Trekker ancestors put their crosses there. And having signed all of it, they were going to leave. And then the king said, "No, wait. We first want to dance for you. My men must dance for you." And so, The Zulu army basically started dancing around them, and then at a certain moment, the king yelled. I got to remember Bulala Aba Tagati. Bulala means kill, Aba means people, Tagati means wizard. So kill the wizard people. And so he yelled that, and the whole army descended on this little knot of men. They were killed and impaled, and both my wife and I lost ancestral family members who were killed and impaled in that event. That cannot go unpunished. So on 16 December 1838, the Trekkers were ready to go up against Dengaan. Again, they did so with the help of other black people. Shall I repeat that? They did so with the help of other black people, all of whom had been wronged by Dengaan in some way or another. They'd all been pushed out of their land, stuff like that. So these guys went up against Dengaan together and defeated him at what became known as the Battle of Blood River, which was actually a very close-run thing. The Zulus are an incredibly brave people. They're an incredibly disciplined people. They had really very, very good, if not brilliant, tactics. They had the horn of the bull tactic, I should call it, by which two groups of the army would outflank the enemy on two opposing sides, and then the third group, who would be the most mature fighters, would dash through the middle, and that would be the head of the bull. The two horns were the group that wore the enemy down on the sides. So they knew all about outflanking maneuvers. They knew all about where to place what warriors. They had bone whistle signals to organize the men over large distances. They said they had men to waste, in their opinion. So they would throw an army of 15,000 men against the 400 Trekkers. It's not a very equal fight. The British, with a three times larger army and much better weapons and much better equipment, went up against the Zulu 40 years later and got completely obliterated. There was nothing left of that British army. So our guys only won, as they believe, because of divine intervention. The fog came down during the night, and the Zulu army sat there surrounding these Trekkers, and they sat in the fog. The guys could hear them. Had they attacked in that fog, it would have been all over. But they didn't. They waited for the fog to lift. And even then, it was a close-run thing. And in the end, the Buddha realized that the only thing left to do, because they're running out of ammo, is open up the wagon circle and ride out. And 100 ordinary farmers turned themselves into a cavalry. And they charged the Zulu. And they had to do it 3 times. And they shot as they charged. These were farmers who knew how to shoot, and they had these massive elephant guns that they used that always seemed to awe everybody. So it was a close-run thing, and the history needs to record that the Zulu fought incredibly bravely. But in the end, they broke, and they ran. And they tried to escape through the river, which turned red with blood, and since that day, it's been called Blood River. Politicians have tried to abuse that day. It's now being abused again. But I think that battle stands in testimony to the bravery of the Zulu, the incredibly good preparation of the trekkers, the absolutely solid faith of those men. And they made a covenant with God, repeated on 3 nights before the battle, to say that if this coming battle is given into their hand, the day of the battle will forever be commemorated as a Sunday, and a church will be erected in God's name. The church was duly erected, and the day has duly been treated as a Sunday evermore by my people. And it so happens that that is my birthday. 16 December is the day I was born on. So my birthday has always been politicized. If Mandela's people planted bombs, they always aimed for my birthday. And I could never go to the movies because it was a Sunday and the movie houses would be closed, or the bioscopes, as we call them, would be closed. So this kid over here, you know, I was a grown man before one could go to the movies on my birthday.
That's wonderful.
I didn't understand much of it, but all I knew was it was called the Day of the Covenant, and it's the day that it's my birthday and I can't go to the movies, period.
Well, Harry, what I want to get across, and we've done that before, but the fact that, you know, we keep hearing from Julia Milana that the white folks, the Boer, the Amabulu, stole Africa from the black people living there.
Yes.
And obviously that's not true. If you look at it historically, it's obviously not true. What were the populations of white and black as late as, let's say, the 1940s?
I guess in that period, there was something in the vicinity of touching 2 million people, that vicinity, whites. And the black population was somewhere closer to 5 million. The numbers were way smaller, and the black population had not yet exploded. I think this is something that folks need to understand. Infant mortality among black people in Africa, in the absence of what white folks did, that mortality was incredibly high. So they had lots of kids and not many survived. Mm-hmm. And the end result, and it's not an easy place to live. It's easier in the tropics, but further south where we were, you know, it's not that easy. And not lots of kids made it. My grandfather, in his collection, there were something like 7 kids, and 3 didn't make it. You know, mm-hmm. They all died young. Mm-hmm. And if it's not diphtheria, it's something else, you know. It's pneumonia, it's diphtheria, it is, you name it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And amongst the black people, there's a lot of underfed kids. They got kwashiorkor and all that kind of horrible stuff. It's a tough continent. It is a tough place. Mm-hmm. And it irks me that folks can sit in the Northern Hemisphere. They're so comfortable. They can have their tea parties and they can have their nice events. They don't really understand what it is to carve civilization out of the solid rock of Africa. It's hard. It's really, really, really hard, and it's precious, and it's dying.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's, and it's important to note that many of the blacks who ended up down in South Africa that migrated there, they did for two reasons. They migrated there for some protection, and they migrated down there for work, because the industrious nature of Afrikaners, they were providing some work for the other people who wanted to be part of that. Isn't that correct?
Well, you know, there's a book standing here behind me, and I don't want to waste your time by giving you beautiful flashes of the back of my head while I search for it. But it's called Africa Everyday Miracles, I think, something like that. It's by a guy called Richard Dowden. And Richard Dowden was a British reporter who reported on Africa. And I often quote Richard Dowden for the simple reason that he hates Afrikaners like me, and I think it's good practice to quote your enemy, because then, you know, people don't have to believe you. So I know nobody will believe me because I'm a white South African. So why not read Richard Dowden's book? He gets to the subject of South Africa, and then he says, well, it's kind of uncomfortable. I can't remember his exact words. I'm sure he'll forgive me if I mess him up slightly. But he essentially says, and one now gets to the uncomfortable reality that people are really braving all of these depredations to get into apartheid from where they were. And there is a program series that ran on US TV. I wish I could remember the chap's name, but he looked at wildlife stuff. Is it Dave Leone or something like that? And one of the programs that he showed, one of the episodes, was about the people from Mozambique who were braving man-eating lion in the Kruger Park to get into South Africa. So, yes, they were braving man-eating lion to get into apartheid. So much for the terribleness of apartheid. I'm not saying it was right.
Mm-hmm.
Please understand me right. But it's like, you know, if the United States is as terrible a place as what some on your left are saying, why are people trying to cross your borders inward by the million?
Right, exactly.
Okay. Welcome exactly. to my world. Welcome to my world. That's what we've dealt with in South Africa all the years, okay? But it wasn't okay to make that comment about South Africa. I'm allowed to say it about the United States, but I'm not allowed to say it about South Africa, because, you know, the truth about South Africa is completely illegal. You may not speak the truth about South Africa. It has been decided what you're allowed to say, and the truth has been outlawed. But the reality is that people brave man-eating lion to get into South Africa. And there was a BBC interview with old B.J. Foster, who was prime minister in the mid-70s. And I could find it again. I watched that just the other night. And he's explaining to this British interviewer that how many Malawians, he actually had the numbers at the time in the mid-70s, of how many people from Lesotho are in South Africa, how many people from Botswana are in South Africa, Zambia, Mozambique and Malawi. Some of these countries had arrangements with South Africa. For example, Malawi, that people from Malawi would come and work in South Africa, and their salaries would be paid to the Malawian government. Now, these days, that would be considered in indentureship, but indentureship in Malawi, not in South Africa. From a South African point of view, they were paying Malawi for the work done by Malawians. And I certainly dealt with many of those people. I dealt with a lot of people from Zimbabwe. So it was a normal thing for people from other parts of Africa to come to South Africa to work on the mines and do other kinds of jobs and so forth. even today still. If you want your sheep shorn in South Africa, you don't ask a Xhosa or a Venda or a Tswana or a South African to do it. You trust the sheep shearers from Lesotho. You can ask any sheep farmer in the Karoo region, okay? They don't trust the local black people to shear their sheep. The sheep shearers traditionally have been Sotho's from Lesotho, and they come from their own independent country of Lesotho to come and shear South African sheep. And they are appreciated, and they're respected, and they're known as the guys who know how to do the job.
Mm-hmm. Well, Harry, we've got a gentleman on with us today, Jason Bartlett, who is actually Afrikaans, and he is walking from Austin, Texas to Washington, D.C. to take up with Congress and the president the plight of the Boer. So, Jason, it doesn't look like we've got Brandy and John Wells on yet, or Hedrick. So, with you not being afraid to be on the air, I would love to have you talk about what's going on now right there in South Africa. You're from that area, and you've actually experienced some of these things yourself.
Yes, unfortunately I have, and thanks so much for that little history lesson. I love listening to the gentleman over here, because Mr. Boysen always gives such detailed stuff that people tend to forget about, like, you know, the little fact that we actually go out of our way to bring in people that sheep shearers from Lesotho. We respect them, as he says, but the respect is at the moment is only from one way, because South Africa, you take a look at his birthday, which is a very important day to our people, and they go and parade around, and they literally say His Majesty Dingaan. But if you look at history, Dingaan is clearly one of the worst things that happened to the entire Africa, would you not say? Because it's just invoked so much hate, and that hate is very much alive, and the hate is growing more than the unity in the year 2020.
Yeah, I want to talk about what's happening there. How recently were you in South Africa? And tell us a little bit about some of your experiences and your family's experiences in some of these farm murders.
So my personal experience, I've been held at gunpoint twice, and I've been held at knife point twice, and I've also been attempted to be stabbed once, where they almost were successful. They stabbed a part of my jacket and got a couple of fists in. Luckily, I can throw them back, and I ran to the police in Cape Town, and the police used the word. They told me to footsack. This is not a proper crime, even though they tried to stab me. And then in 2011, I was in Swazi-Reinicke area, and there was an attempted farm attack where eight of these gentlemen, these pagans, came to my electric fence, and they attempted to get over even after I'd fired an old 303 at them. They ran away and then came back for me, and luckily the neighborhood farmers had heard the shot, and they know I wouldn't just shoot, and they came to for assistance. And then in 2018, I was at my cousin's, and then just before I was leaving to the United States, and thank the Lord I had left, because on the 12th of January 2018, these perpetrators broke in. There were seven of them. And I see on her statement, she has to just say seven non-white people. She's not allowed to say anything else. These people came, and my cousin Dion, at 11 o'clock at night, they took fish nylon and they strangled him, stabbed him in the neck, and then they shot him through the back of the head, and the bullet came out the top of his eye, and he survived it, actually. But when he went down, they decided to burn the grill on him. They burnt him with the barbecue grill, the bribe grid, and they said the white bastard is dead. And then they went after my other cousin and his 8-year-old daughter and 10-year-old daughter, where they beat them with crowbars and said to them that they will be raped if they don't keep quiet. And they ransacked the house and just absolutely kept them, you know, horrible, horrible status. And, you know, I've had a cousin that's been raped. I've had a cousin that's been thrown in the back of the boot, the trunk of a vehicle, for several hours. They've all fled to Australia. And the crisis is very real. Like I was just, I crossed the 1,000 mile mark yesterday. And I had a lady that's also seeking asylum that's, you know, at that, when her children were 2 and 4 years old, these people came in and they attempted to rape the children, held them at gunpoint for hours on end, tormenting them. And if you just read the news last night, there was another brutal farm attack where they're killing people, where even the South African police are involved. It's complete anarchy there. And I couldn't agree more with Mr. Boysen when he says that my dad's always taught me that there will always be a bloodbath very shortly because of the Khoisas and the Zulus. They hate each other, but they also hate every single thing of us. They are. Cyril Ramaphosa is standing up and he's invoking that hate. Julius Malema is invoking that hate. And I don't mind. I'm not politically correct. I'm going to stand up and I'm going to say it as it is, because that's what they are doing. We've got the facts to prove it. And these people are being sent out and they are attacking people. Whenever they attack, they steal guns. And a lot of the time what they do is they rape the woman and the children, whether the child is 1 month old, whether the child is 2 years old or 12 years old, they rape them in front of the parents. And then they will shoot or kill the father because he's the head of the household, and leave the wives and the children violated, desolated for the rest of their lives. And in order to scare them off these farms. And anybody that stands up against what I'm doing, and it just shows you the pure evil of these people, because why on earth would nobody say anything about the murders that are happening in South Africa? What is behind the scene? What is happening? Why are they not saying anything?
Well, that's why we're talking about this today. I want to have you and Harry both address this. Why do you think there's such an incredible hatred? And do you think there's any justification to it? You know, I know Harry tries to go out of his way to be extremely fair about that, and he'll point out every single infraction. But the reality is that there was never slavery in South Africa, and you know, the Afrikaners were not evil, brutal people until they were pushed into a corner. So what do you think is justification for all these attacks against the Amabulu and all of the white institutions in South Africa?
Can I take a shot at that, Dan?
Sure,
Harry.
Absolutely.
There's a first of all, humans are, in the end, when all is said and done, they're fairly basic animals. And I think the idea of behaving in a non-racist fashion on things is a higher element of function of humanity. If you take the really most basic people, you're going to find that they cling to their tribe, they cling to their nation, they cling to their skin color, you name it. Okay, so as far as I'm concerned, many of the black people in Africa just see that other people look different, and that's enough to fight with them. That's just the end of it. It's not deep. I think people look for deep answers where there are not deep answers to find. That's the one aspect. The really big concern that I have is that I don't have it against the black people in South Africa. I have it against the white people in North America and Europe. And the reason I put it that way is quite simple. Europe has got a massive guilt complex about colonialism and slavery. And the United States is nursing a massive guilt complex about slavery. And the problem is, both groups are white. Or the ones that see themselves as having done it. They forget that lots of black people had slaves, but let's not get into that. That doesn't fit the script. So in the end, we are conveniently available. When you look at us in a picture, our skins are white. We speak a language derived from Europe. Our principles are Christian. Our way of working is Western. We are an integral part of the Western world, And therefore, we must be resented because we are not Africanists. We are Africans. Okay, an Africanist is somebody who thinks that that which was created out of the raw Africa is the thing that has to win. And so when you look at what happened elsewhere in Africa, take the Portuguese. Awfully few Portuguese in their colonies were actually born there. I really mean the people who lived in Angola and Mozambique. It's a tiny minority that was born there. Most of them came from Portugal. If you look at the old British colonies, even including Zimbabwe or Rhodesia, those folks who populated, the white folks who populated Rhodesia in the 1970s and 80s when things got intense, at the very earliest, it was their grandparents as grown people who first came to Rhodesia. There were very few people who had three generations there. Kenya, even less. So if you look over Africa at these guys who colonized the place, it is a different history from the one that we as a nation lived. Our people arrived in 1652. The real colonization of Africa started in the 1870s after the Berlin Conference. The Berlin Conference is when a bunch of European countries, and the US was invited, for the record, and Russia, they were invited, both turned it down in the end. But this conference was held so that the European countries could decide how to carve up Africa. And Britain was going to get a swath that ran from Cape Town to Cairo. And then the French would get a lot of that north of the equator and west of the British swath. So that's why you see so many French countries, French-speaking countries to the west of that line. The Portuguese already had patches in Africa, so they could hold on to what they had. The Italians got a cut in Somaliland, Ethiopia, etc., etc. And the basic agreement is they would all turn the other eye while the country that had the allotted section had its way with that part of the world. And what they did was awful. And the entry, and then they said these two cute little patches where the United States and Britain decided they would go and dump their surplus slaves, their freed people. Yeah. So Liberia got freed American slaves, and next door Sierra Leone was exactly the same for the Brits. Mm-hmm. So lo and behold, if you had a guilty conscience about slavery, here's what you could do if you were in Britain or the U.S. You could emancipate your slaves and then move them out to Liberia or to Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. Do you understand how crazy that is? It's like taking the white slaves from Europe who had been captured and taken to Libya and Tripoli and those places. And if they got taken in Cornwall in England, you take them and you unceremoniously dump them somewhere on the Italian coast. And you say, there you go, we'll call it Liberia after the word liberty.
Right.
So it's like creating Liberia in Greece for, you know, Cornish miners taken as slaves out of England. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what happened. That's the truth of what happened. And the problem is, as those people discovered when they settled in Liberia, they were not accepted by the locals. And that is why you had a mess like with that leader, Samuel Doe, and those people in that part of the world. The local indigenous black people felt nothing for these folks. Zip. They saw them just as new oppressors. Oh, these ones are black. Big deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Harry, we'll go back even a little bit further than that. Let's talk about the fact that slavery existed in Africa even before colonialism. And the fact is that Black Africans enslaving others were the ones that really started providing the victims for the slave trade. Am I right in saying that?
That's correct. If you look at the single country that probably provided most of the slaves that ever went to the Americas, plural Americas, like typically to Brazil and maybe then transported from there to the U.S., it came from Angola. It is not by chance that the black husband and wife I met in Washington in last year, it's not by chance that one of them could hold up their cell phone and show me that their DNA company had found that they had an ancestor from Angola. It's not statistically correct. Angola played a very big role. Well, the point is that one of the very powerful black kingdoms there was the Bakongu tribe. And the Bakongu played a very big role into the present. And the Bakongu would sell the others into slavery. In the end, they were themselves taken, but they did a roaring trade selling the others. Okay? And then to show you how ironic and cynical this picture actually gets, in the mid-1800s, you know, take a guy like David Livingstone, a great hero of the British and of lots of Christian people, presumably because they haven't read the whole thing. He was a member of the London Missionary Society, an organization that I despise. I don't think it ever had any moral standing whatsoever. It had no moral principles. Not to my mind. I don't understand how they look themselves in the eye in a mirror in the mornings. David Livingstone, the great David Livingstone, he was really good at finding, you know, the origin of the Nile, the source of the Nile, I should say, etc., etc., etc. But how about people evaluate him as a missionary, please? Because that's why he went there, supposedly. Well, he made one convert. Well, kinda, sorta convert. And that convert was Sebetwane, the chief of the Makololo, as they were called. And those people who later became the Makololo originally attacked a place in South Africa and were driven off by those Khoi people I mentioned earlier. It was his father-in-law. It was Livingstone's father-in-law that wrote to the Khoi to go and ask them for help in defeating this horde that was attacking them. And the Khoi came, defeated them, and then Sebetwane fled northwards, right over the Zambezi River into what is now Zambia. And Livingstone visited him there, and Livingstone wrote at one point in a really glowing terms about what a wonderful chief this guy is. He is the absolute epitome of the perfect African chief. All kinds of glowing words that Livingstone wrote. And he was forced to swallow it later because it turns out that Sebetwane was a slave trader. Sebetwane was selling young men into slavery. Period. Okay, I suggest the London Missionary Society lives with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of that kind of history, Harry, and I would say that the biggest reason that we've got such a change in history with the current leadership of South Africa and the ANC and the new group by Julius Malema and others is because
Malema
and others is because they are trying to sell communism in basically a capitalist society, and the way that they can sell that communism is by creating a tremendous amount of jealousy and hatred for the so-called haves by the have-nots, and getting all these people stirred up to the idea that somebody stole something from them rather than created it themselves. Isn't this really the bottom line, is that we're facing a fight between communism and capitalism?
Dan, we are, but I consider the black people of Africa, I consider innocent in that regard. And I'd like to explain why I say that. They're not thinking about this stuff in terms of the two big isms of the West.
Oh, no, no. I never intended to say that. But that's the basics are there. I mean, that's what they're doing. They're selling communism.
It comes from a completely different place. There's a thing called African socialism. It knows nothing about communism. And before people thought up these fancy Western words, and long before there was a Karl Marx to write garbage and paper, you had a situation where in the African societies, the chief had complete authority. He had authority of life and death. And so let's call him a king for a moment. We'll take the kings of the Amakosa, for example. That king had complete and total authority. An individual farmer did not have land. There was no such thing as the individual Khoza owning land. What happened is the Khozas all collectively had a piece of land, which they got by defeating somebody else or chasing them off, typically. So there's this patch of land they have that's however many miles by however many. It could be anything from 5 by 5 to, 200 miles. Now, the point is that the chief would then tell an individual family where they could go and build their homestead. But it's not as though they owned that land. There was no such thing as title. The African culture does not recognize the concept of title. And that is why this is such a ripe a human territory for communism. You don't have to explain communism to them. You just have to say that you can't have individual title to something. Because they don't understand what individual title is.
Right. We've got the same thing in America with Native Americans. It's a concept based on tribalism.
Yes, and it's the same in South Africa. Well, I wouldn't know. I don't know the details of the American folks' way of doing things. But a tribe, they will tell you if their king is dead, they consider themselves practically dead. You know, if you don't have a king, you're nothing. You are only something because you have that king. And that king is going to decide everything about you. And the king is going to have sons, you know, and if it's the first son of the number one wife, number one doesn't mean first, it means number one in pecking order. If you are the first son by this king of the number one wife, you get to be king after the present king, and many times you're going to kill your father in order to get the job. Mm-hmm. So, and then if you have brothers by any of the other wives, they get given some people. They're assigned people by the king. Often these are the same people who were at the initiation school with you and their associates. So you go to initiation school when you're like 16 or whatever, and you go there with other boys your age, you get circumcised, all kinds of stuff happens, you get called a man, you can now take a wife, etc., 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 but you're a clan. Now, those people go off together to basically seek a new patch of land, and you would typically do that by defeating someone. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you take his cattle. So he's hungry. He's got to go and steal cattle elsewhere. What are they supposed to do? So they have this system that is based on this continual strife, continuous population growth, and forever somebody has to go and dispossess someone to have something. And then when they own it collectively, and it's the king who doles it out. Okay? Yeah. So when they say they wanna have the land, for the tribal guys, it means, yeah, well, sure, no problem. The king is going to have it. The only reason why some of this is blowing up in the present government's face is because in 1994, the king of the Zulu, or I shouldn't say the king of the Zulu, Gacha Buthelezi, Mangosuthu Gacha, as he's called, Buthelezi, the main leader of the Zulu, didn't want to take part in the big election that brought Mandela to power. If the Zulu had stayed out, it would have basically turned the election into a farce. So the only way they could get him into it was that a deal was struck that I believe Henry Kissinger was part of. I can double check on that last statement, but Kissinger was involved in getting Buthelezi back to the table. Whether he was a co-signee to the deal, I don't know. But the deal was that the major part of the territory of Zululand would be given to the Zulu king to administrate. It would not be treated as a regular part of South Africa. And now the central government, the Mandela government, because it's still the Mandela government, is trying to nationalize that land, and the Zulus don't want to play. Mm-hmm. More particularly, the Zulu king is not going to give up the land of the Zulu, and he said he will secede from South Africa if they push that any further.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, and it wasn't Jacob Zuma. He was Zulu, and he certainly played into that.
Well,
program.
Zuma was he's still a Communist Party member. Mm-hmm. And Zuma was not directly part of that dispossession exercise. This question of taking away the land came along with Cyril Ramaphosa, the present president. What happened there is the Secretary General, I'm not sure what the titles are, I think it's Secretary General, of the ANC is a guy called Ace Magashule. And to get the support of Ace Magashule for his bid for president, Ramaphosa went on the night before the internal headcount, the equivalent of the DNC convention, right? The night before the convention, it doesn't sound too different from what happened last Tuesday or last Monday night before the DNC exercise. There was a big meeting held, and it was decided that if Ramaphosa will push the dispossession of white people, then Magashule's vote is in, and he and his votes would support Ramaphosa against essentially the family of Zuma, who was trying to take over the presidency. And so Ramaphosa became president. But he is severely weakened. There are forces of all shades and types all the way around him, and plotting in the middle sits the South African Communist Party, which has kind of played the violin for these guys all these years. Make no mistake.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I agree with you. It sounds like Hedrick de Reich is on with us. Hedrick, are you on?
Yes, thank you, Dan. Thank you. Hi, Harry and Thumper. I'm here, and apologies if I'm late.
Well, Hedrick, I want to mention that we've got Jason Bartlett, who's going to be on later with us in an evening program, but he has joined us because he's on a walk from Austin, Texas to Washington, D.C., to really point out the plight of Afrikaners. As you being someone who is right there, right now, talk a little bit about, you probably overheard at least part of our discussion. We're trying to explain how tribalism and communism are part of the reason that so much of Black Africa has such a hate for Afrikaners, and that it's being kind of created, kind of ginned artificially to make everything white and everything capitalist a scapegoat for all the failed policies that are coming out of the ANC and the communist elements of the government. Give us a little bit of your opinion on that.
Yes, Dan, and I've heard what Harry said, and it's Harry gives a good overview of our history, and our forefathers, as Harry will probably mention or confirm as well, when they came from Europe, they understood the African way, and they saw the Africans worked in tribes, and the only way to survive as a minority in Africa, our forefathers, you know, started to think in that direction of becoming a tribe themselves. And that's how we became the Afrikaner, because we had to adapt or we had to die. And that was the only way to survive, was becoming a tribe. We can, you know, it's moving very much towards the tribal thinking. It's already in that way already. There's a lot of faction fighting, as Harry might have mentioned, in the ANC. And this was predicted by P.W. Botha, the president before F.W. de Klerk. He said, well, if the black people are going to come into power, and I speak in a general sense of black people, because I would say a lot of the majority of them is more following the opposite of when we were doing apartheid, we followed the American model. When they came into power, they more in allies with the socialists and the communists and all those guys. So I think the communists and all these people are actually taking advantage of these faction fighting, because it's making South Africa, adding to the instability of the whole country. And we can see there's a tense thing in the air when you go places, and you know, people are really with their heads in the sands, because if it's a survival thing, and I think in their gut and everything, they know what's going on, but they don't want to know really what's going on, if that makes sense. Also, maybe to mention with the BEE, or Black Economic Empowerment, this year they're pushing that aggressively. So that's adding more division with everything in the country. If I can maybe go into that direction as well, I don't know if you mind.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Thumpy, if you maybe just show slide number 5, just for your listeners, and just to explain to them if they don't know, BEE stands for Black Economic Empowerment. It's a form of affirmative action.
Henry,
but I just see.
Can you describe for me slide 5? I lost the.
It says BEE, Black Economic Empowerment, a form of affirmative action.
All right, let me find it here.
Okay.
Apologies.
So it's similar to what you know in the U.S. as affirmative action. We also have affirmative action this side. But I mean, this has been going on for 25 years now. And it's probably the only country in the world where a majority of 50 million use race laws on a minority of 4 million. I've spoken to a few people, and one was a leader of the Malaysian Democratic Party, and he mentioned to me saying, what you have in South Africa is not affirmative action, it's pure racism. Not.
I agree with that, if I may. I think to even mention American affirmative action in the same breath as South African BEE, it is just so infinitely worse, Hendrik, that we shouldn't even let Americans think it has anything to do with affirmative action. It does not. It is a way of designing the economic collapse of a nation. It is willful. It's premeditated. There's no doubt about what the plan is.
And it's Harry, to interject something, it's giving someone an opportunity to own and take over a business just because of the color of their skin, and taking total economic control of the businesses that have made South Africa successful.
Here's the thing. Let me take it for you the way I see it, and I would beg Hendrik to interrupt and correct me where I have it wrong. He's right there, and I haven't seen it in a few years. First of all, at the lowest possible level, of this ladder of hell, you have affirmative action, an effort to give black people a fair shake in the economy of South Africa, involving some of them in jobs where they may not have had a decent chance before. I don't think there's anything necessarily terribly wrong with that. You go up one level. Now you start turning it into active quotas. Now you do have that in some respects in the United States, sometimes with universities and so forth. But I'm not aware of any jobs that are reserved on a quota basis for skin color in the United States. If I'm wrong, this is the time to tell me.
But well, actually, we've got Pocahontas, Elizabeth Warren, yeah. Because she's Native American.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
That quote by your one Republican commentator the other night was hilarious when he said, "I never thought I'd have to wait most of my lifetime to see a political candidate pay $485 million to be scalped by a fake Indian." Anyway, so the second level is where people have their jobs reserved on a quota basis based on skin color. Okay. But that was also not good enough. So they came along. They couldn't steal fast enough. Let me be blunt. The ANC could not steal fast enough. So they invented BEE. Black economic empowerment. According to that, and they handled this by sector. So there was the mining sector, the banking sector, et cetera, et cetera. They started developing quotas for these sectors that there would be so many black people in middle management, so many black people in lower management, so many black people with a controlling share, et cetera, et cetera. So they did it that way. Then one level up, they started saying, okay, now hang on. If we look at all these guys who now lose their jobs because they're white, they are now going to try and form their own little businesses. I don't care really what it is. Is it a carpet laying business like what my one cousin has? You know, what is it? Doesn't matter. But if his revenues are more than 1 million rand, then if he then to get the sort of right number of score marks for brownie points, if you wish, he would have to have a black partner with a majority shareholding. So we're now going to force the guys out of their jobs. Now you essentially force them to cough up half of the business they create because they've lost their job. Okay? But that wasn't bad enough yet for whites. They must first suffer even more. Okay? We don't want to kill them because then we kill the goose that lays the golden egg, right? You have to make sure that these guys that you've neutered keep working. Otherwise, you, the ANC, may actually have to do something useful. And that's terrible. The whole idea of a communist organization doing something useful is just, it's anathema. So they came with yet another level. And that is that the big companies would score their brownie points in terms of who they were buying from. So now the bigger companies were being told who to buy from. They had to buy from companies that were majority black. So here's this guy. Look at it through the eyes of a working white stiff now. He loses his job because he's white. He can't get a job elsewhere. What does he do? Well, he goes into one of those squatter camps that nobody wants to believe exists. Okay? Or exists. Or he tries to make his own little business. If he tries to make his own little business and he dares to get a bit of money in, he has to give a majority shareholding to somebody who has a black skin. The only qualification is he has to have a black skin. That should tell you something right there. But that in itself is not yet bad enough. You've got to make sure that the places where he goes to get business will only give him business if he does have this shareholding by blacks. He must be controlled by a black guy, then he can go and get some business from these bigger organizations. And to make sure that the bigger organizations play by those rules, they only qualify for government tenders if they have those brownie points. So if you're a big contracting organization that would normally have contracted out smaller jobs to small white businesses, you are now either going to conform to the government system, or you're not going to get the big construction tenders for the country. And always remember how unique the United States is. Because it has 300 and almost 50 million people, it means there's lots of private companies that can collect together enough cash to do stuff. That's not true in other countries. In most other countries, the only place where that kind of capital concentrates is at a government. They're the ones who put up the money for the dams, for the roads, for the et cetera, the big construction things. And so it means that little Joe Blow, who's lost his job and now forms his little business, must make sure that he's got a certain black shareholding, otherwise he's never going to get a job from another company. And it's insidious and it's evil.
Well, and that black shareholder doesn't have to do anything to have that ownership. I mean, they don't have to work.
Yeah. Where I come from, he doesn't have to do jack. He's, you know, diddly squat, as some folks would say.
Yeah. Henrik, I want to give you a chance to, now that Thumper's got this chart up, can go ahead and finish your thoughts.
And I just want to add to what Harry said there as well. I know somebody, and many people know somebody and very close with this Eskom problem with electricity. I'm not sure about your listeners knowing how electricity goes into load shedding, you know, where you get a certain time that goes off for 2 hours because we cannot generate enough power by the looks of it, because we're probably selling power to Zimbabwe and other countries. So I'm not sure why we should still do that.
If I may, Henrik, it's like rolling Californian blackouts without Enron.
Yeah. So this person that I know in the early 90s, and a lot of these people had to train up these affirmative action people to actually take over their jobs. So this person actually left for Australia now, and like many other people that left working for Eskom, they had to train these people up, and they, you know, can't do the job properly. So I can just imagine when coronavirus comes, those few guys that's keeping the electricity going, what will happen then? But coming back to the BE points that I was speaking about earlier, this it's also broad-based black economic empowerment. I think it encompasses the whole thing, if I go by that name. So each company will get a level one, level two, level three. So the more levels you, if you're level one, you write at the top. So you get all the government tenders and, you know, all the good stuff. So in order to get these points, you need to fill in certain criteria. Thumper, if you go to the next slide. So just to give you the weighting point system there, if you've got a black executive directors, the amount of directors, you get 2 points. And then compliance targets is 50%. If you've got so many black females, you get so many points. And your compliance just goes up and up and up and up. So, yeah, that's part of it. I'm not sure what the next slide there is, Thumper. All right. One of the interesting things that I think is a bit concerning for me is America tends to give a lot of funding to these type of black economic empowerment program. And one of the most recent ones I picked up was Amazon Web Services. And it was giving $25 million to this broad-based economic empowerment equity equivalent whatever name you want to call it. And a lot of these funding goes into black training only. Only black-owned businesses get funding. No white entrepreneurship companies or no funding or training for black employees. It's pure black training funding. So I think that's a bit, you know, that I don't know what you gentlemen think, you know, about stuff like this, but I don't think, you know, it's not balanced. It's not about equality. It just comes back to, you know, funding black nationalism, racism for me. I don't know what you think. Harry?
I'd like to hear from Jason. Jason, you've been there recently too, so let's hear what you've got to say.
The BEE policy is, like Hendrik was saying, let's just say the truth. It's complete and utter racism. It started off with a country where, you know, the communists and these evil terrorists like Nelson Mandela promised everything for free. And now the people, you can't be angry with them because they're expecting the stuff for free. And they continue to dumbfound the people. And they go, for example, I've seen with my personal own eyes, I come from a place called Freiburg. In the Northwest, when it's voting times, they literally drive out to these little rural areas. I've seen it with my own eyes. And they hand out what you call millimeal, like a 25-kilogram bag of millimeal, and they just bribe them for votes, as simple as that. But like it's disturbing to see the stuff that's on the screen, yeah, like Amazon giving 25 million. They don't even hide it anymore. It's just blatant. It's out there, you know, black-owned startups.
The fact that... Millimeal is corn flour.
Yes, corn flour. So, you know, they go and they bribe them for the votes and stuff. And they like I say, they've been promised free things. And these people want these free things. And it starts at the top that they thoroughly believe that the land was stolen from them, even though the proof in the pudding is there. It was never stolen from them. They want what they have not created. And they play the guilt card and the racist card. And because, like we spoke in the beginning, there's this tremendous white guilt that comes from Europe that's now progressed into the United States. And people like myself, who are 33 years old, who have absolutely bugger all to do with any apartheid, with any made-up fake media policy that's full of hate. I've not been part of that, but I have to suffer the consequences. Now, my people that are exactly, the white squatter camps are sitting in white squatter camps. They're educated. I, for example, am a qualified pilot, and I was told by SAA recruiter, I was told to F off, you know, because of my skin color. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous there that, and the world needs to just start gradually talking about it. Yes, they can be racist. And the part of this, what's happening, you asked it earlier on. Why do we think that there's so much boiling hatred in South Africa, and why is it getting worse? It's because they hate us. Not all of them. There's some beautiful black tribes out there that are very, very good humans. And but people like Cyril Ramaphosa and the Zulus and the Khoisas, they purely hate us, and they are driving that hate within to us. And they're using the media to just grasp that and ride off it. And, you know, within our own people, the Afrikaans nation, as well as here in America, there's so much evil from within our own people that are riding that gravy train. You know how many people make money off the BEE by bribing the blacks? We can't, you know, look at that. We can't look past that either. And it's just a money laundering thing. They have absolutely looted all the money. Eskom, there's no such thing as wet coal and all these little fear mongering that go around. They've looted and they've stolen all the money, and they have not got the capacity of the educated people in those positions to make these entities run. Because I've said it before, name one singular government entity in South Africa that works. Nothing.
I wonder if I could just mention that one night, several years ago now, I got to confess, I nearly tore the paint off my own wall here in Canada. My wife put an investment prospectus down in front of me, and they showed these various funds. And then they had one major sheet called ethical investments. And amongst the ethical investments, they particularly listed companies that in South Africa conforming to the government's BEE principles. I want you to know that this kind of evil is sold here in North America as ethical investments. It is time for people to ask questions.
Yes.
You know, how many of us must die before
Harry,
people in North America will start to think?
Harry,
what's ethical about that?
And I don't think it's a matter of being so much being ethical is the fact that what we're doing is we're communizing North America, just like you had happen in South Africa. So they're controlling the dialogue. They control the press. They control the dialogue. And they're promoting the same kind of crap that South Africa is going through.
Can you imagine what will happen if those four females, whatever you call them, with Tlaib and AOC and those, if they get their hands on this BEE score sheet?
Oh, yeah.
Can you think what's going to happen in the U.S. if they get their grubby idiot paws on a BEE South African score sheet?
Well, Harry. Yeah, and Hendrik, go ahead. Get back in this discussion.
I want to say, like what Jason and Harry said and what we said in the last program, what they are doing, all these things are deja vu to us, what we see happening in the U.S. And this whole thing, they're recycling all these stuff. You know, the thing about when they called us racist and all that, that things unfortunately got stuck because we lost the propaganda war. They're trying these things all over again now, but with you Americans. You can see the guys on Twitter and on YouTube, and they call you guys racist here to try and shut you up. But the good thing is about you guys is it won't stick because you're a majority. Unfortunately, we paid the price for it. I can see the same thing happening with Israel. With this, what I mentioned last time, they want to recycle the word of apartheid by attaching it to Israel and saying it's an apartheid state. It worked once, now they want to use it again. I just want to come back to the BEE thing to show you the result of BEE. There's an estimate that there's about one-third of our population. I mean, we're 4 million whites in a country of 50 million black Africans. They say about one-third of us is already sitting in squatter camps or below the poverty line. This video is about 30 seconds, Thumper, if you can just play that, just to give you an idea.
Explain to us exactly what your organization does and who you are and how this all came about.
Yes, I am from South African Family Relief Project. Our organization assists the minority groups who are refused assistance from the government. We have about 460 of these white squatter camps in South Africa. Out of the 4+ million white South Africans, over 1 million whites are living in these dire conditions, and the government is refusing to assist these people.
So this is the result of the BEE with these race laws. You know, for 25 years, we had these laws against us. Now we're sitting in these camps. For 25 years, the black people don't have these laws anymore, and most of them are still sitting in black squatter camps as well. But eventually we'll all get poor because of these laws.
Well, that's the problem, is that communists are a little bit challenged when it comes to maths. you can keep stealing from 4 million to make 50 million rich. In what universe does that math work?
Well, those people have been forced to stay where they are. They're not there because they're not willing to work, and they're not there because they're not willing to grow and develop stuff. They have been forced into that situation, which is incorrect. And that's a lot of what, like, I'm only 33 years old, but that's why a lot of Americans have reached out to me, because I say to them, I'm not from the future, but I know what the future holds because I've seen it. And like Hendrik said earlier on, so spot on. It's like a deja vu. What I see here on a daily basis in the United States, the little things that happen, you know, like the art being pulled down in the universities and the comments on Twitter and Facebook. I've seen it all. And it's not that I'm an extremely educated person. I'm just not blind. I, you know, I let myself want to see the stuff so you can actually see it. It's there and it's in broad daylight.
And Jason, I phrased it slightly different to folks that speak to me. I told them, I'm newly arrived from the future and I'm here to tell you, you don't want to go there.
Yeah. Well, spot on. It's true. It's so true, man. It really is. And, you know, you're talking about ethical earlier on. I just wanted to elaborate on something. Where are the, you know, because something doesn't fit person's agenda, some lady from the EU said that she, you know, these people that are on little boats landing in Greece now from Turkey, yeah, the migrants and so forth. She said she physically got sick when she heard that two officers shot two bullets into the air because of the Muslims on these boats trying to go to Greece. What about these farm murders that are absolutely horrendous, not two shots fired in the air, where people are dissected and taken apart and mutilated and torn into shreds and raped at the age of 1 month, and women stripped of their breasts and, like I say, mutilated in absolute horrendous ways on a daily basis they attack. Where are the people saying anything that that's sick? I think it's absolutely sick that no one says and utters a single word. I don't care about anyone's color. The fact of the matter is not about the color. It's about how can nobody say anything about these brutal things. You look at John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy and all these people. There's documentaries on these horrendous murders. If one farm murder had to happen the same way it happened in South Africa, in America, you would have a movie about it, let alone they don't say anything. So it makes me sick, and that's why I'm sick and tired of this. And it needs to be, people need to speak, yeah. Hendrik. As well,
you're right, Jason. You're absolutely right. And I think the biggest hypocrites, especially in our case from the 80s, were these anti-racist liberals, which shouted anti-racism. They actually closet racist, most of them, it seems like, because as long as it fitted their narrative, they were against racism. But now where we are the victims, they've dead quiet.
We have an interesting situation now with this coronavirus thing where, you know, I live in Canada. You're looking at me sitting in Canada, the arch non-racist country of the planet, right? The one that had a lot to say about South Africa and very proud of its role in bringing down apartheid. But at the moment, our newspapers and media are full of Chinese people complaining that white folks are walking up to their shop windows and writing "Go back to China" on the windows, and all those things that happened to the Jews in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
A tiny, measly little challenge to Canada. A tiny little thing, like a bloody virus, okay? Hardly on the scale of the regular flu. Mm-hmm. And Canadians lose it comprehensively,
mm-hmm,
and start, you know, like one Chinese lady complained that she walked into a shop with a face mask and a woman walked up to her, punched her in the shoulder and told her, "Go back to China." You know, okay, yeah, so that sounds very much like Judenrausch to me.
Gary, I want to say something about that. It shows how easily the human race can be led into the stupidest ideas in the world, because the lamestream media and all these people who are in control of the dissemination of information have figured it out a long time ago. You can lead a bunch of sheeple into the stupidest things in the world if you just control the media.
Yeah, you're right, Dan. Yeah.
You know what a Judas goat is, right, Dan?
Give it to me.
A Judas goat is the goat that they keep at the abattoir. And when you got a new heap of sheep coming in off a truck, they'll stand there and bundle around and carry on. And what you do is you, down the passage, you just let in a goat. And then the goat knows its job. It just walks down the passage, and the sheep follow it, straight to the abattoir. When you get to the slaughtering spot, the goat keeps walking and the sheep get stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, it's time for Americans to start wondering who the hell is the Judas goat in this picture.
We've got a lot of them.
I was wondering, Dan, we've got like 20 minutes left, and we haven't got to the land issue.
Let's get to it.
So you had some history, you know the background. Mm-hmm. You know by now that no, land wasn't stolen from black people, but that there were areas that truly were theirs and have always been treated as theirs. But right now, the thing that's happening in South Africa is that the government says, white people stole the land and it must be given back. And Ramaphosa says he's going to make sure this happens. Now, as an intro to this, I wonder if Thumper could play one of the clips I sent him. It is a representative, the spokesperson for an organization called Black Lives Matter. Sorry, not Black Lives Matter. Black First, Land First. Same thing.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I wonder if Thumper could play me that Black First, Land First little clip. And just imagine that being spoken by Black Lives Matter.
Give me a moment while I pull it up.
Okay.
And at the same time, Harry, imagine that statement being made by a white person and the outrage that you would see.
So this is what we know. South Africans know what this woman is saying. It's not like it's news to us, but it was news for Lauren Southern.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of her program about South Africa. And I think that young lady, Lauren Southern, had the awakening of her life when she went there.
Harry, is that number six on the list there?
It's number six on the list.
Got it.
Yeah. From minute 656, 656. And Katie Hopkins was there more or less at the same time. And I know that Katie Hopkins is very, very deeply affected by all of this. The moment she starts saying South African farmer, you can see her ears actually cloud. Her eyes cloud up, okay? You can see it. That lady has taken a heavy knock. She's finally understood what this is, and she can't get it out of her soul. So this is Lauren Southern interviewing Black First, Land First, minute 656, clip 6.
And that, incidentally, is the farmland movie that Lauren Southern is famous for making.
Yeah.
And that's up to minute 656, correct?
No, it's from minute 656. You're at the right place.
Okay.
You are handovers. We don't want you to feel pity for us. We are coming for you and we are going to get everything that you own. It's ours.
Talking to South Africa's black political class, it's quite clear that the...
Okay, well, Lauren Southern goes on to explain that all is not what it seems, etc., etc. That little clip says everything you need to understand about the thinking. It's really not deeper than that. That's it. Africa is not a continent that's known for its deep thinkers. Name me one.
Yeah.
If you think I'm wrong, name me one.
Well, I watched Julius Malema, and he's about as deep a thinker as you're going to get in that group. And what a scary individual, because he's also the same person who says that we've not threatened to kill anyone. And then there's all these videos of him in front of a large crowd saying, kill the Boer, bang, bang, bang.
That's clip five, if Thumper has five around there somewhere.
Yeah, let's do that one.
You know, Julius Malema is not the brightest peanut in the turd by any means, because you can see, like I see that recently the Khoisan have now said he must go back to Ethiopia where he comes from. So he's busy barking up a tree he knows nothing about.
Yeah.
This is it.
Yeah.
Look at this.
To kill, Kumasa. Shoot to kill, Kilo This the poor, the farmer. This the poor, the farmer.
There you have the philosophical depth of Black South Africa.
Yes. I hope Europe opens their doors to these poor people, you know, like the EFF, and just lets them flood
in. Let them in.
You know, let them, give them land, and because it all belongs to them. Everything, the whole continent belongs to them. Because if you look at all this pathetic, like Ancestry.com, we all come from one black lady in Africa. So obviously they all own everything. So
that's a great idea, by the way, Jason. I would like to invite Angela Merkel. Feel free. Take them. Feel free.
Amen.
Anytime you have an attack of guilt, feel free.
Yes.
I don't require Germany to make any further restitution for World War II. May I suggest they get over themselves now? Okay? But how about you take these guys?
Hendrik, we want to give you some time because we're running out of time.
I agree with Jason and Harry, and I just want to mention, I'm sure you probably have conservative African Americans listening to your show as well. I've got quite a few friends, and they're conservative. They're really good people, even in England, gentlemen that I've known there. And I always explain to them, and the ones that's been over do understand this. But we have the left and the right is more clearer in the U.S. than it is in South Africa. Yeah, it's just a one-size-fits-all. You're either part of this left bubble or you're not. And you're either a coconut or a Uncle Tom or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I want to mention, I've got, as Afrikaners, we have more in common with conservative African-Americans than African-Americans have in common with black South Africans, generally speaking.
That's
the only thing they have in common is their skin color. Other than that, when it comes to color, zero.
Well, like I said in my meeting with this one family in Washington, they took out their cell phones, showed me where they came from, and I could tell the gentleman that, okay, so you have an ancestor from Angola originally, a slave ancestor from Angola. So do I.
Yeah. You know, last week I was actually on the Patriot soapbox and a Zimbabwean phoned in, a black gentleman originally from Zimbabwe, and he said everything started in Zimbabwe when they took the land from the white people, and he had to flee because of poverty that was going to come. So he said he couldn't flee to South Africa because the black nations in South Africa were too violent. He had to move up to England. That's not from me. That's from him. And he was a lovely person when he called in. He just said, thank you for what I'm doing as well. Because of that. Because we've seen it, man. Why are we letting history repeat itself? I mean, if you take and kill all these farmers and you take their land like you want, they can't run it. Look at Mandela's old farm. The cattle starved to death on the dairy farm. You know, where are the animal rights people talking about? What are they going to run? They can't even make millimil for themselves, let alone corn maize for them, for the whole nation. They're going to starve themselves out, man.
And so, adding to what you said, Jason, I work with a Zimbabwean gentleman. We're on the same level, on a senior level. And I asked him the other day, what do you think, is South Africa going the same route as Zimbabwe, which I know what the answer is. So I just wanted to see what he says. And he says, yes, it is. And he doesn't know what to do. He's quite, he's very worried. He thinks the only option now, and he's already doing it, is to leave the country. I said, well, where are you going? He said he's going to New Zealand. So because, you know, the Zimbabweans could flee to South Africa. If we turn into Zimbabwe, there's no other country except the sea or abroad. And that's the other thing that I wanted to mention is, for the people that can't leave as a minority like the Afrikaners, we need to have an area for self-determination to flee to, like a place like Orania or other places inside the country.
Mm-hmm. So
similar
I wanted
to what the Jews have in Israel.
I wanted to get to that because the way I see it, there is no way that all white folks can leave there.
Yeah.
It cannot work. Number two, there is no way that you can kill 4 million people and hide it. Can't work. So if you're not going to kill all of us, and all of us can't leave, what are you going to do? Going to let them die in the squatter camps and hope that no TV company comes to see? Okay, we're really at a point where that needs to be discussed. You can't kill 4 million. You can't throw 4 million on boats and make them float away. And you can't have them die and rot. There'd be too many corpses in these camps. You can't do that. So what are you going to do? Because we are now there. What are you going to do? And so in the middle of all of this, the government issues a report about land, saying, no, 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 white people's land must be taken, meaning farms. They're very clear about that, but they write the law to cover all other property. So when you listen to CNN and the BBC and all these parties, because they all sing out of the same tune, they constantly tell you that white farmers own 80% of the surface area of South Africa. They own 80% of the land. Well, let's check. The ANC government's own report of late 2017, I think it was November 2017, it says that individual white farmers, that's the people who are being murdered and threatened with expropriation, they own 26.8 million hectares. Okay? So I thought maybe what I could do is go to the CIA fact book, the World Fact Book, and find the surface area of South Africa. It turns out to be 122 million hectares.
About the size of Texas, I guess.
Yeah. So what you do is you divide 26.8 million by 122 million. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that that's roughly 21.8%. Now, last time I looked, and I'm not totally sure about this, and Dan, you know, I have to be careful because I know the American media avoids ever using real numbers, but 26.8 divided by 122 is not 80%. It's not 0.8. In fact, it's 0.218. It means 21.8%. So someone in your system and someone in Britain is causing the BBC and CNN to say that white farmers own 80% of the land when the truth is they own 21.8%. Then we look at that land and we ask, where is it? Okay, and you can make a nice simple calculation. If one removes from contention the two provinces where they've always been, for the reasons I've explained before, almost no black people, that would be the North Cape and the West Cape, then the surface area that remains, according to the government's own report, is 71.8 million hectares. In the remaining area, white farmers own 12.5 million hectares. Of that 71.8, that's 17.4%. So, in other words, when you leave out the west of the country, which is basically mostly desert, these much maligned and attacked white farmers don't own 80%. They don't even own the 21.8% for the whole country. What they own in the area of contention is 17.4%. Guys, the government itself, the ANC itself, owns more than 20%. Why is it that land must be taken from the whites if the government has land that's more than that? Will somebody explain that to me? There's only one answer. It's called stick it to the white guys. Anything to make them suffer, anything to make them bleed, anything to rub it into them, morning, noon, and night. And they will continue to do that until we are worse than dead because CNN and the BBC are aiding and abetting them in this process. And when these farmers die, I see CNN stenciled over their bodies and BBC stenciled on the foreheads of their dead bodies, okay? That is how I detest these two organizations for their continual lying. And maybe now that everyone has seen how they can lie about President Trump, people may just possibly start to believe us when we say, guys, they've been lying to you all the time. Mm-hmm. Wake up.
Correct. Yeah.
And I have to say, if they're successful in creating the world that they see, we can look at a template of that in Zimbabwe after the fall of Rhodesia and Ian Smith to Robert Mugabe. What a wonderful success story that's been.
Oh, yeah, definitely, Dan. And I mean that when they go through with this land reform here, like they did with apartheid, I can guarantee you, like they exported apartheid to the Western countries, if this is successful, they will want to do the same with this land expropriation to the U.S. in what one way or form, or Australia or New Zealand or other countries that our forefathers founded. Mm-hmm. So that is definitely going to happen, I'm sure of it. And just on the what Harry said as well, if we have our own land, we need to go to our own land if something happens to us, because otherwise people will be killed or end up in squatted camps.
And this
one
is
of the options.
This is why I think the only pragmatic option in the end, whether by fighting or by voting or by talking nicely, I don't care. The only solution in the end is that the western part of the country, if we go back to the very first slide of the very first show, maybe Thumper still has it, the one that shows the line, the dotted line running across southern Africa. We need the Western Cape and the Northwest and the northern North Cape provinces to be basically hived off from the rest of South Africa and to be turned into a homeland for those people who are not black. Not a white homeland, that one. If you could just reduce the size, Thumper, it would be great. Now I mean, that we need to see the whole picture. Yeah, there you go. There are two provinces of South Africa wholly contained west of that green line where black people have never really been. That is the West Cape, which stretches along the south coast mostly, below the mountains. And then north of the mountains, you have the Northern Cape. Most of the Northern Cape is to the west of that green line, the bit that is not going to be left behind. My contention is that the only solution to avoid bloodshed of millions is that the west of the country has to secede. There is no other workable option. I know that there are very good men who are trying to create a homeland on the prairie, but their hearts are in the prairie. I understand that. But it's not tenable. It's not workable. They'll be overwhelmed in 5 years flat. They'll just be outpopulated before you can breathe in twice. The answer is... To the west of that dotted line, the so-called colored people and the white people together and some Indian people, a whole mixed polyglot of people over there, and the predominant language is Afrikaans. It's not one of the black languages. You can look at the maps of language. The major language, majority language in the west of the country is Afrikaans, and that's because it's mostly spoken by the so-called colored people of mixed descent. The truth is, all of the white people and colored people are of mixed descent. I don't care how they try to explain things. You bring me any white South African and I'll show you he's got slave ancestors somewhere. So the end result is that I think all those folks are non-Bantu. They don't subscribe to the Bantu culture. They have now been vilified and attacked to such a degree that they are upon the face of the earth a persecuted minority. It is time that the Western world stepped in and ensured that the area west of that dotted line be made their homeland where they are in control and not the Bantu people of the ANC. Period.
Agreed.
Okay, so what do you say to farmers that are in the Northwest where I come from that have been there since the 1800s? What do you say to them? Hey, we're going to give your land away. You have to move now. And the rest of the people in that. So I can agree with what you're saying, and I understand to avoid a bloodbath. But sometimes you've got to stand up against evil, and what's happening in South Africa is evil.
it's evil, and the folks can stand up. Jason, I know it's an unpopular point I make, but I'm trying to make it before everyone's dead.
I understand what you're saying.
And Hendrik, Harry, I'd like to give Hendrik a chance to say something here, because he's going to have to get off. Hendrik, just say what you think of this idea.
I agree totally with Harry and Jason. I mean, I know where Jason's coming from. You know, keep your ground, keep your farm. You know, we're armed, and we're not stupid. We're not going to give in our arms. But if somebody needs to retreat somewhere, there needs to be a safe haven. And that's where we need this area, just in case something happens. But then I want to have another backup plan to ask, you know, to ask for the asylum in other countries, in the US, in Australia. I know in Australia they're already probably ahead of it. But we the nearest an Afrikaner will come to anybody on this earth is an American, in culture, in values. We don't just speak a different language. On top of that, I just want to ask for slide 10. And I want to go back about 110 years ago with the Anglo-Boer War, when one of our famous generals settled in the US. His name was General Ben Viljoen. Thumper, if you can just show slide 10. And this is what he had to say. If my country was lost to me, I wished to choose a flag to live under for myself. I did not only feel, but I was perfect, a stranger in my own country. My home destroyed, my money confiscated. No hope, held out that any restitution would ever be made. Where I used to be somebody, I was now not only nobody, but I was an intruder, an unwelcome guest. I mean, if this isn't as true today as it was in after 1902, then I don't know what is. History repeating itself. Ben Viljoen is buried in New Mexico in the U.S. Go and read up on him. Very interesting fella. And that's all I have to say, you know, to keep in mind for that plan C.
Well, gentlemen, we're out of time. This is absolutely a heartbreaking but a fascinating discussion. We're going to have to do this again sometime very, very soon. Jason, you're going to be on with us a little bit later today. Hendrik, thank you for your participation in this.
Thank you, James.
Harry, you know, you and I are friends. It is always such a pleasure to have you on, because you're such a brilliant man and you're such a great speaker. Thank you. With that, gentlemen, thank you again. And we need to turn the program back over. We've got Patrick Howley's campaign show coming on. And Patrick, glad to see you back. Thank you. And gentlemen, thank you. And join us again next week for Connecting the Dots.
And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence.
It was 1776 when the founders signed the writ of independence from the Brits. It was revolution. Now an enemy from within would enslave us all again and deprive us of our rights in the Constitution. Restore the Republic. Wake up, it's time to understand. Restore the Republic.